Hello and welcome to this week's Some Other Scotland headline newscast with me, Mick Burdey. In Scotland's news this last week, sunken U-boat pictures released. The coast, by Eyemouth in Berwickshire, is the home to a German U-boat torpedoed by a British submarine during the First World War. It was discovered recently by a team of divers who found the wreck and released film of the submarine, the U-40, more than 90 years after its sinking in 1915. Data centre may bring 1,000 jobs to the borders. New data centres proposed for Dumfries and Galloway could bring jobs, new homes, improved sports education and community facilities to the area. An outline planning application has been lodged for the substantial building project that will include hundreds of new houses, as well as the 20,000 square foot data complex itself. Vampire blog tells sea tales in real time. Diaries of a sailor dating from the mid-19th century are to be released online in real time. George Douglas from Kelso described the journey of his vessel, the Vampire, to ports all around Europe. Visitors to the blog will be able to read the entries on a daily basis from April until January. Confidential patient files abandoned. Boxes of confidential patient files were left unattended in a corridor in the Southern General Hospital in Glasgow. The lapse of security was brought to light by a BBC reporter, resulting in the setting up of an urgent inquiry into the matter by the Health Board. Queen returns for Parliament anniversary. It has been confirmed that the Queen will return to the Scottish Parliament building in July to address MSPs, marking 10 years since the historic opening of the Scottish Parliament. MSPs will also attend a reception given by the Queen at her Edinburgh residence, the Palace of Holyrood House, as part of the event celebrating the anniversary. Tartan Week parade ends in disaster. On a day when New York should have been celebrating its ties with Scotland as part of the traditional parade along 6th Avenue, it has instead been reeling from the attack on the famous Empire State Building. The top 5 floors of the building were demolished in what is believed to be a terrorist attack, though evidence of an explosion has yet to be found. The estimated death toll currently stands at over 200 people, including several killed by falling debris. The building, opened in 1931, was for many years the world's tallest skyscraper. It became New York's tallest building once again following the destruction of the World Trade Center in 2001. Shootings threaten seal population. According to the Seal Protection Action Group, up to 5,000 seals are being shot around the coast of Scotland every year. The action has been taken by members of the salmon farming industry who are legally permitted to shoot seals outside their breeding season in order to protect their fish stocks. The Scottish salmon producers responded to the allegations by confirming that under 500 seals have been shot in comparison to 30,000 attacks by seals on salmon farms in the previous year. Both the Scottish and UK parliaments are debating marine bills within the next few months, which could answer the issue. Don't forget to vote for next week's podcast subject at the website, which is someotherscotland.blogspot.com. You can send any feedback about the podcast directly to me using the address mickburdey@gmail.com. You'll also find us at Facebook and Twitter, and links to those can be found at the website.
Is that him, Mick? Is it time?
No, Norval Joe, it can't be. No, the sun isn't up yet. He always waits until dawn to make sure we write through the whole night.
Thank heavens. How's your story coming?
I'm still struggling to explain how the vampire monkey bots managed to travel back in time to ancient Egypt to unleash the genetic plague that wipes out the secret cats, and thus...
Hold on, mate. Have you forgotten what happened the last time you messed with pets in your story? Do you still have scars from those 50 lashes?
Yeah, fair point. I still think that chihuahua got what it deserved, though. Yappy, scabby wee dugs. How about yours?
I finished my story. This one's a winner, I'm sure of it. No stale bread and stagnant water for me this week. I just need to dig out my harmonica to record the introduction, and that's me done.
Hey, where do you keep that thing hidden?
You don't want to know, man. You really don't want to know.
Shh! He's coming.
Deep in the most miserable dungeon of an ancient castle that sits atop a dark, menacing mountain, Lord Height's minions sit, chained to rusty typewriters, producing stories to meet his every whim, week after week after week, all to entertain you.
And the Dark Lord Height commands you to find them at greatheights.blogspot.com. Go or suffer the wrath.
Some Other Scotland by Mick Bourdais. Episode 14. Razor had three options to get away from home, from the trouble he was fairly certain would be on his heels as soon as the real owners of the device heard news of the disintegrated wall he had left behind him. He knew how these things worked. They would see a report in the news, recognise the damage done, recognise him from the CCTV images of the train, and be straight after him. The sort of people with weapons like that weren't the usual street thugs or drug addicts he knew how to handle. They were organised crime gangs or shady government agencies or terrorists. He had no idea which, but knew that none would have any qualms about killing him to keep his knowledge secret. His first thought was to head for Spain, to the little Scottish-themed pub his father ran on the island of Mallorca. He'd been there a few times in the past and felt at ease amongst the tourists and expats, and even the occasional Spanish person. Like Suckyhall Street with Sun, he'd thought, a home away from home. That would have been too obvious, though. They'd have traced his mother and father and would have been waiting for him to step off the plane. That left Susie or Kyle. Some choice that. The ex-girlfriend or the internet buddy? The girl who broke his heart and hated the sight of him? Or the man who lived on the other side of the planet, who he'd never met, yet shared his love of rapidly depleting 60s music icons and poetry? Chances were good that Susie would be so tied up with her latest conquest that she wouldn't even open the door to him, and he managed to convince himself he had always wanted to go to America. He pulled out his mobile and sent a message to his American friend via Twitter. His computer was in storage since the accident, so there was almost no room for anything more than a bed and a bag for his clothes in the B&B the council had provided. He wasn't able to email his friend. He didn't know Kyle's number, so he couldn't have called by phone, as their communications had always been through chat rooms, email or Twitter. It didn't matter, as he received a return message within seconds, and in a matter of a few minutes, they'd arranged to meet at the usual place. Upon opening his front door, Malcolm was reminded once again of the need to get a peephole fitted. Two well-groomed men in dark suits faced him. One, heavy-set, about the same height as Malcolm's 5'6", with shoulder-length curly brown hair. The other towered above him, comfortably over 6 foot, wiry and a little twitchy. Before either one could get a word in, Malcolm launched into his regular offensive.
Oh, sorry boys, I'll save you the trouble right away. I'm from a long line of Protestants, first of all, so I have tradition behind me. I'm also in my 60s, so I very much doubt there's much you could do to convince me to change to the Jehovah's or Mormons or whatever it is you boys are. No offence, right, but you better go and find some young folks to have a wee blether with.
Mr. Fraser? Mr. Malcolm Fraser? The taller man asked.
Aye. Hey. How do you know my name?
Mr. Fraser, we are not members of any church. We are here to talk to you about your job.
Now, just a minute there. My taxes are all up to date now. You can't come here claiming that...
Mr. Fraser, you are not in any trouble. We have nothing to do with the revenue office or your employers. We are concerned that you may be in some danger, however... The tall man interrupted him.
No, that can't be right. I just drive the trains, pal. There's no danger there. Round and round I. Some days it's clockwise, some days it's anti-clockwise. But as long as I stop at the red lights, there's no danger.
Malcolm insisted. Not even from falling rocks?
Oh, aye. I suppose so.
Mr. Fraser, we are looking for a certain item that was lost in the underground tunnels shortly before you found that poor unfortunate soul who had been trapped in the wall. We are fairly certain that the man you found was about to deliver this item to us when he was killed.
I see, said Malcolm. And this item would be what exactly?
The two men glanced at each other before the tall man answered. It's a torch. Black, about a foot long. Have you seen it?
A torch, eh? A torch,
Malcolm said. He prided himself on his law-abiding nature and would rarely fail to report a crime in progress if he saw one, and he witnessed quite a few in his line of work. Most often it would be vandalism or petty theft on the platforms. On occasion he'd seen the odd bit of suspicious behaviour that turned out to be provocation for an assault or armed robbery. His conscience told him to point the men in the direction of the young man who had picked up the torch that night. But his instinct told him there was something wrong with these two men. The whole situation was just too peculiar. Yes, maybe on the train tracks or nearby? The tall man asked.
So, let me get this straight. You lost a torch, or this dead guy lost it, and you traced me here. You come out to my house at 10 o'clock at night, dressed up to the nines, the two of you, to see if I found it. Is that about right?
The long-haired man shuffled his feet, looking somewhat uncomfortable. His colleague stared Malcolm straight in the eye to answer. Yes. Did you?
No, never found a thing. But I'll tell you something for free, Malcolm said, leaning out towards the man.
Please, anything you can tell us might help track it down, the tall man said.
Well, when you do find it, I'm going to do us a favour and bring it back here. I'd love to see what's so special about some bloody torch that causes you two numpties to be scouring the city, digging through personal files and disturbing people in the middle of the night.
And with that, Malcolm closed the door on the two men before they could say another word and returned to the television programme he'd been watching before they arrived, hoping that the cocky young lad he had met on the train would not get into bother with these two men. They met in their usual place, as agreed. They had never actually met before, never even spoken on the phone, but at least once a week, until recently, their virtual personas had met up online to race through the streets of a stylized New York City. In the game they played, along with others from all over the world, they would meet at Soldiers Plaza to start their races. Razor would complain that Kyle had the upper hand because he actually lived in the city, whilst Kyle in return would point out that if he drove in half the places they could drive in the game, he would already be locked up for dozens of traffic violations. Besides which, he pointed out, he didn't actually own a car because everything he needed was in walking distance. In the real world, the location was Grand Army Plaza, but as soon as he arrived, Razor had recognised it. Kyle, likewise, had recognised him just as easily. Razor may have been relatively streetwise in Glasgow, but here he stood out like an American wearing shorts and a Hawaiian shirt would do in Easterhouse.
Dude, we need to get you into some decent clothes. You're just about screaming out, mug me in that outfit,
was the first thing Kyle said to his friend.
No, man, this is the look in Glasgow. I'm leading the pack, you know.
Seriously, dude. You're in the shopping capital of the world. If you can't find something cool to wear here, then you might as well give up. Come on, my treat.
The two young friends got on even better in person than they did online. Despite the different lifestyles they led, every evening they would either return to Kyle's flat to listen to Neil Young, Roy Harper, or Bob Dylan CDs, or else find some cafe with live music and just sit back and listen. Kyle had taken a few days off work as a loss adjuster in the city to show Razor around the spectacle of New York. There were many things in common with Glasgow, Razor told him. The parks, an eclectic array of different architectural styles on show to start with. The back chat and banter in certain places. and the no-go areas in others. The scale of the place, however, was a different matter. New York was so much taller and so much more expansive than Glasgow that Razor's home city felt small in comparison, despite its place in history as the second city of the empire. He really hadn't wanted to accompany Kyle to it, but the Tartan Week parade through New York a few days later turned out to be an impressive spectacle for Razor. His mother had often talked of her childhood visits to the Cowell Games, held annually in Dunoon on the West Coast, where thousands of pipers from all round the world would come together as the highlight of the gathering. He imagined the sound of the bagpipes there would not have been unlike the effect of the massed pipe bands now marching along 6th Avenue. The nearest he had seen to anything of this nature were the annual Orange Marches through Glasgow in the summer, marches he despised for the bloody history they carried with them and the sectarian aggression they stirred up. And yet he couldn't help but become spellbound by the pomp and majesty surrounding the events, the colourful flags and banners and the rousing banging of the drums. Ostensibly, he and his friends would have gone along to shout and jeer at the other side, to try and make them miss a beat or break ranks to give chase. In truth, Razor always fancied the idea of joining in, grabbing a drum and beating along as the crowd cheered them on.
"Hey, there's that guy from the X-Men movie. Is he Scottish?"
asked Kyle.
"Aye, or at least he was. It's funny how these guys are all so gung-ho about Scotland when they're no living there. It's all a bit, Hollywood Braveheart, isn't it, but..." "No, know what I mean? Him and Jerry Butler and Shershon the Embra Millionaire Milkman. Millions these guys make from their blockbuster movies, and where does it all go? Is it helping Scotland? Aye, this is what Scotland they're supposedly so proud of. Is it hee-haw? It's going straight into offshore funds in the Caymans, I'm sure."
"Gordon, you're such a cynic. These guys do a lot of work for charity, you know."
"Aye, right. You know what they say about that beginning at home, though, eh?"
Razor scoffed.
"They've certainly put plenty of security on. You'd think the Prime Minister was visiting as well, wouldn't you?"
Razor looked around. There were at least 8 men within the street immediately around them, dressed in the standard dark suits of the security services. But he noticed they were not following the progress of the parade. Every one of them seemed to be looking in his direction.
"Hey, Kyle man, I think we've got a wee problem. Those aren't security goons, they're the reason I left Glasgow. Oh, seems like they tracked me down. I need to get away from here, PDQ man, let's go."
They made their way through the crowds, moving away from the route of the parade, trying to be as subtle as they could without rousing suspicion. As they did so, it became clear that several of the men were definitely following them, standing out as being the only people moving away from the parade. Their pursuers stepped up their pace, striding through the crowd which thinned as they headed south, in the direction away from the massed bands.
"Oh, should we not be staying with the crowds?"
Razor asked.
"I don't think so, dude. Looks like they're all packing heat. They get close enough and they can shoot you and nobody would even notice. This way we got a chance to get away. I know these streets pretty damn well, don't worry. Just keep heading down here until we get to the park."
After 2 blocks of fast walking, they broke into a run, followed by 6 of the men who were no longer making any effort to hide their chase. Razor guessed that the men who weren't chasing either had gone for more assistance, or were reported to the superiors that their prey had been sighted. When they arrived at Bryant Park, Kyle led Razor towards the trees, where they soon found cover from the approaching men.
"What now?"
said Razor, between large gasps for breath.
"Just keep out of sight. There are enough people in the park that it will take a while for them to scout around for us. As long as we keep them all accounted for, we just need to wait for the right moment to slip away,"
said Kyle. They watched patiently for a few minutes as the men made their way around the park, guns now drawn in readiness, though held by their sides to avoid being noticed. Once in a while, one would stop and talk into a concealed microphone, relaying instructions to earpieces worn by all of them, the others answering, reporting on their progress or lack of it.
"Ah, dude!"
shouted Kyle without warning. Razor saw his friend launched away from the cover of the tree to fall on his back about 20 metres away. He was holding the side of his face with his hand. Another suited figure stepped out from where Kyle had been hiding behind the tree, holding a gun pointed straight at Kyle's head.
You have 10 seconds to show yourself, Mr. Greenlaw, or I will be forced to shoot your accomplice, the man announced. Razor took a moment to realise this new arrival must have been one of the men who didn't initially follow him. He must have taken another route and approached them from behind, guided by the man giving the instructions in the centre of the park. He had no choice but to comply, so took a deep breath and stepped away from the tree.
Oh, here I am. Didn't hurt him, though. He's got nothing to do with this,
he called out. The device, please, Mr. Greenlaw. You know what we want. Don't waste our time, said the new arrival. A surprisingly short man, with cropped white hair and a face that looked as though it belonged to a banker or a lawyer rather than a terrorist.
Don't give it to him, Razor,
Kyle shouted, sitting up.
He'll kill us anyway to keep us quiet.
Your friend has made a fair point, said the man. With his eyes fixed on Razor, he pulled the trigger. The gun made little more than a quiet thud sound, but the bullet tore through the side of Kyle's head, spraying the grass with red. His body slumped back to the ground.
The device, now, the man said, his voice raised yet still calm and controlled.
Razor leapt back behind the tree, his instinct taking over, not giving any thought to what he was doing. He knew they would kill him whether or not he gave them the weapon, so he pulled the day sack from his back and pulled the cylinder out, turned it to face away from him, and prepared his fingers to press the two indentations in the same way he had done accidentally some weeks earlier. One of the men they'd been watching appeared from the side of the tree, gun held up, looking for his quarry. He spotted Razor and swung his gun to fire, but it was too slow. Razor's finger tapped the device, and the almost invisible beam of energy tore through the man. The effect on Razor's bedroom wall had been shocking, but in a human body, the weapon was devastating. A red glow engulfed his attacker, who had enough time to register that something painful was happening to him, but not enough to let out a corresponding scream before he was rendered into a cloud of ash. Razor gasped at the effect, stunned for a brief moment at what he'd done, but brought back to reality by the sound of gunfire and bullets thudding into the tree he was standing behind.
This is very foolish, Mr. Greenlaw. You can't escape us. Even if you get away now, we will track you down, shouted the white-haired man.
Razor turned to face the tree, providing his cover, then stuck the weapon out to the side, pressed the two buttons, and strafed the area he had last seen the man standing in. The man was nowhere to be seen, but a large smouldering trench had been left in the grass where the weapon had hit the ground. He swung back behind the tree. In the distance he could see three of the men he had followed on the other side of the park, now running towards him, guns at the ready. He lifted the device and aimed it at them. His first shot hit the ground in front of them, creating a long furrow through the short grass. They dodged round it and straight into Razor's second blast, all three disappearing in the same way as the first man he'd killed. There were three men left, Razor thought to himself, or at least three that he knew of. He scanned all around him, his eyes darting from tree to tree, across the park. Around cars sat stationary along the nearest street. There was no sign of them.
Not so mouthy now, are ye?
Razor shouted in defiance.
Not so brave when I'm the man with the big gun, eh?
There was no answer. He crept around the tree, eyes still racing around to spot the remaining men. He stumbled, cursing himself for tripping, but as he fell, the blood on his leg told him he had been shot. He hadn't heard the gun, but he was down, and he was in trouble. The three men stepped into view, and Razor gritted his teeth against the pain that screamed from his bleeding leg. He scrambled to pick the weapon back up that had slipped from his fingers when he'd hit the ground. It took a moment to get it back into position, to get both fingers at the correct angle to fire it, by which time the three men were only meters away, their guns pointed at him as they paced onwards. He pressed the buttons and the beam leapt out, striking two of them indirectly and the third, the white-haired man, on the arm. They disintegrated before him. Ash floating away in the breeze, the only remains of the two dead men, whilst the third fell to the ground, disarmed in both senses of the word, screaming in pain for his missing limb. Razor released his grip on the device, a grip of fear that had turned his knuckles white, and the beam ceased. The damage had already been done, though. Razor had held it on for too long after killing his would-be assassins. The beam had continued its destructive path, over the tops of buildings into the distance, and all he could do was watch in horror as the top 5 stories of the Empire State Building crumbled and slid off, the tower keeling over as it fell to earth. My thanks this week go to Philip Norville Joe Carroll for providing the voice of Kyle. He's a regular contributor to the Great Heights podcast and can be found online at norvalsoutlook.blogspot.com or followed on Twitter at Philip Carroll. I've included his links at the main website show notes. If you're listening to this podcast at Podiobooks, please do take time to visit our main website at someotherscotland.blogspot.com, where you can vote in weekly polls that will change the plot of the story. You can download spin-off episodes and other special chat episodes for more background about the series. The music from this podcast is from the track No Strings Attached by The Lunacy Board, who can be found at www.lunacyboard.com. The podcast is produced under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license, which means, in a nutshell, that you can copy it ad infinitum, email it to your friends, stick it on your webpage or your MP3 player or iPod, anything you like. Just so long as you don't change it in any way, you don't make money from it, and you let people know where it has come from originally. someotherscotland.blogspot.com